Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Happy to be rejoined today by Josh Blank, research director for the Texas Politics Project. Happy summer morning, Josh.
Happy summer morning to you.
Happy in Austin means, you know, We're going around while it's only 90, or maybe even high 80s. And I know you're going to give us that glass half full right now.
No, it is. You know, listen, hey, man, it's not barely been 105, you know.
Yeah.
If it's like 90, 95 degrees, I'm wearing pants. You're in a suit.
Yeah.
You know, this is...
Well,
I just...
that's because, you know, we have duties and
yes,
commitments.
That's true. We do.
So, you know, today we'll focus mostly on the Texas perspective on... the dominant story in national politics right now, the state of Joe Biden's reelection effort and, you know, the pressure on him to drop out or not drop out, or, you know, we'll sort through that over concerns about his age and health that have continued, but were certainly catalyzed by his debate performance on June 27th, which has now been a couple of weeks.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, you know, time's a funny thing, but like on the one hand, you know, it's crazy that it's been 2 weeks. It's crazy that it's only been 2 weeks because in some sense, you know, the amount of like psychic energy that's flowing around in different circles about this, you would almost think that, you know, I don't even know what I would think. And that's part of like, did this happen, you know, does it feel like this happened a month ago? Did it feel like it happened yesterday? Like, it's just so... present in the political space right now that it's kind of weird. It defies
right.
a certain amount of logic.
So we'll come back to that. Well, you know, yeah. I mean, in the abstract, I guess. But once it happened, it, you know. But I think, you know, we can't do a second reading podcast without noting a similar or a concurrent or follow up uptick in state politics in the aftermath of the impact of Storm Beryl in Southeast Texas. You know, at one point, over 2 million people without power, which is a soft spot in Texas politics right now, whatever the cause, you know, we'll unpack a little bit, I suppose. And what was going on in terms of state leadership, Governor Greg Abbott, you know, who, you know, we were talking about this earlier, and we can unpack this a little bit more. I mean, like most governors, I mean, I think Governor Abbott knew from the beginning that natural disasters are, you know, a time when the governor is out front and center, you know, with their emergency jacket and stuff,
right?
And, you know, being, you know, Johnny on the spot in these kinds of situations. Greg Abbott is out of state, was out of state when the storm hit. Out of the country on a trip to East Asia, which was essentially an economic development trip.
Yeah, states opening up an economic development office in Taiwan, basically.
Yeah, if you want to, you know, read, to my mind, too much into it, but, you know, the fact that, you know, this also seemed to, you know, burnish his profile as somebody who could handle himself on the international stage, but that has, you know, been complicated. So that left Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick as acting governor, and... you know, the initial storm, you know, cone for this and predictions for this storm had it sweeping through Texas after it made landfall, but had it, you know, a few weeks out, including probably when there would have been the decision point for canceling this trip, had it hitting in northern Mexico and the storm track, you know, moved farther east and wound up hitting, you know, pretty heavily populated areas of Texas. There have been deaths and, you know, as we record this on Thursday morning, a few days after the storm hit, last I saw, there were still about at least a million people in Southeast Texas without power. It's very hot. There's a heat warning. And there has been then come out of this some political maneuvering that, you know, not to downplay the severity of what people are suffering, but if you follow politics, it's been somewhat interesting in that the argument coming from the White House has been that the Texas leadership was asleep at the switch in asking in advance for a declaration of emergency and all the federal right. support that would come with that. That's been partially, at least, disputed by the state's legislature in no uncertain terms. And President Joe Biden, you know, went as far as to, you know, call a couple of reporters at the Houston Chronicle and, you know, sort of, you know, make the point that, you know, he didn't hear from anybody. He was trying to get in touch with the Texas leadership, couldn't get in touch with anybody. Again, there's been hard pushback from that. To be fair, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick said, you know, I was standing next to a bunch of FEMA guys. They could have called those guys and, you know, a lot of other things. But, it, you know, based on some reporting by Jeremy Wallace in the Houston Chronicle yesterday and reporting slash looking back at the history of these disasters, you know, as of now, it does suggest that whoever should have made the call,
right,
getting the advance declaration of an emergency or disaster from the federal government, which would have made resources more quickly deployable, seems to have been a little late and not happened on the usual timetable.
Right. And, you know, that's all interesting. And we'll find out more about that as that goes on. I mean, the pure policy, and again, you know, you're right to point out, I mean, look, people have died. This is very serious. Let's take a step back from that and just talk about the politics of this for a second, which is, you know, this was an opportunity for Abbott to, or not for, for Biden to stick his finger in Abbott and Patrick and really every Texas official's eye. Because if you follow Texas politics, I mean, it is without, you know, a day does not pass in which Biden is not blamed for every, you know, any and every ill under the sun, including, you know, any sort of assault or murder that's made anywhere in the country by any undocumented immigrant, no matter when they came in the country.
Right.
So, like, you know, if anyone wants to say, hey, that's, you know, that's untoward, that's plain politics, I'd say, well, like, let's just, you know, I mean, let's be realistic here.
This ain't beanbag.
And to the point, and this is, you know, maybe is a good transition here, is, you know, one of the strengths of, you know, you'd say, well, why did Biden now decide to sort of, you know, throw his stones back? And it's like, well, because this is actually a very soft spot, right? And we've seen this in our polling. Even in our most recent poll, we saw, you know, large, you know, high percentages of Texans who were concerned about being asked to conserve energy, concerned about rolling blackouts, concerned about other blackouts. And though this is a natural disaster, you know, one of the main arguments that Democrats have really been hanging their hat on and trying to mobilize in the last few election cycles, and I expect to continue mobilizing, is that, you know, essentially that leaders are asleep at the wheel, that they're not taking care of sort of the basic necessities here when we talk about the safety and reliability of the grid, when we talk about responses to natural disasters. You know, you can think back to Hurricane Harvey and sort of the mixed messages that were coming out of different parts of government. Now, look, anyway, we were talking about this morning. You know, the governor very astutely has already pushed back, and, you know, both on the direct charge, but also about where the responsibility lies, saying, hey, you know, maybe Houston could get a little better at this. Maybe Harris County could get a little bit better at this. And I think
that's a pretty familiar play.
Yeah, it's a familiar play, but it's also, again, we're talking about politics here. It makes sense. But this is why I think, you know, if you say, why did, you know, Biden stick his head up, you know, to kind of go at Texas this time? It's like, because this is a soft spot, you know?
Well, and, you know, I would think that the Biden team and Joe Biden himself are, you know, very alert to opportunities to change the subject from what we're about to talk about.
Well, let's talk about
that. Which brings us to, you know, the situation with Joe Biden.
He will be here next week, should mention.
Who will be in Austin on Monday to celebrate the anniversary of the Voting Rights Act at the LBJ School in a speech that is not open to the public. You know, you can only fit so many people into I think he's doing it in the auditorium. So it will be an invite-only event.
Mine must have been lost in the mail.
But, nonetheless, this is, you know, he's coming Monday. You know, and there are a lot of different places we can start. I mean, I don't think we have to sort of recount what's been going on. If you're listening to this, you probably have a pretty good view of it. This morning, there is a new Washington Post, ABC News, Ipsos poll. That is not particularly good news for Joe Biden.
Right. Yeah. In that poll, a majority of Democrats, 56%, said that President Biden should end his candidacy. 42% say that he should continue to seek reelection. I think, you know, most, you know, I mean, that's real troubling. I was going to say maybe even more troubling was 70% of independents think that he should end his candidacy.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you think about it, you know, a national polling only tells you so much because really we're talking about the state polling. We're talking about outcomes in a handful of states. But this is where that 7 in 10 number among independents becomes really problematic because those elections are incredibly close. And if he's not polling well among independents in those states, it's going to be really hard to match his outcomes from 2020.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this, you know, with all the, you know, with all the due caveats, one poll,
yeah,
et cetera.
And if I were the Biden people right now, what I would be saying is, yeah, but those, you know, this is what they would, I think, would say is, yeah, but those 56% of people will vote for me anyway, but the 42% might not vote for somebody else, would be the argument that I think I'd be making.
Yeah, and, you know, I think, you know, and there will be various rebuttals to that.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
I was gonna seize on that number and say, you know, that is just a particularly, you know, that just pours a little more kerosene on the fires burning over this in the Democratic Party right now, because, you know, in many ways, just because of the, you know, the little debate you kind of presaged there, which is probably already going on as we record this, you know, if more than half say you should end your candidacy, that flies in the face of what the Biden arguments have been from Biden himself.
Right.
That, look, this is completely an elite phenomenon.
Right.
The voters have cast their votes in the primary. This is decided.
Yeah.
You know, Joe is their guy. Well, you know, this, you know, I mean, what they're going to fall back on is what they've fallen back on. Like, well, these public polls, our polls are not showing this. Internal polling is not showing this. The polls are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They were wrong before, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and so I think, you know, this is, you know, we will see. I don't want to prejudge, you know, what the empirical research will show, but this is not going to be the last bad poll for them on this subject in the next couple weeks. And, you know, it may be that, you know, Democratic elites are a little more in line with the Democratic base. Now, 56%, big number, but in some ways, not big enough.
Yeah, I mean,
in terms of people wanting to make the argument to the president that he needs to drop out of the campaign.
Right. No, I mean, it's a bit of a coin flip. I mean, I think it's also something, you know, without more data, you'd say it could be a bit of a soft attitude, you know, in the sense that, I mean, there's two things I think about this result, just to throw it out there, just from a pollster perspective. One, it is a snapshot in time for sure. However, I think it's pretty safe to guess that had this question been asked 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, before the debate.
There would have been a significantly lower share than 56% saying that he should end his candidacy. Now, that's a little bit unfair, but the point I'm making is, as of right now, that, you know, we can guess what the last result would be. We can look at this result. We'll see some more results in coming weeks about this. But ultimately, I imagine this is on a trend line that's probably going to get worse before and or if it gets better.
Well, and it's a common observation, but it's worth saying, I think, that, you know, the problem that drives that is that this is not a new issue.
Right.
That, you know, there is a lot of polling out there. We've done some of it, you know, in various states. It's kind of, you know, the poll questions about Biden and Trump's age are out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, this line of, you know, the debate and the subsequent line of public discussion, this, you know, the scrutiny, you know, what Biden's public performances look like under increased scrutiny now reinforce the narrative, the biggest problem the campaign had. Put it that way.
Right.
Because his age and his suitability for, you know, his capabilities in office itself were the biggest problem that they had going into this. This reinforces that problem.
Yeah. Why don't we jump into some data with
just
to show where it is. I mean, the only other thing I was going to mention on that one result is just to say, you know, you get 56% of Democrats saying that Biden should end his candidacy. I think if you were to imagine a bigger, more robust exploration there in terms of saying, well, what if the candidate were so-and-so?
Yeah.
What if the candidate were so-and-so? My guess is that there's almost no candidate who would actually outperform that 56%, potentially given how close the numbers are. And that's not to say that there's, you know, some, you know, I mean, I think the point is there's no magic candidate out there. We'll kind of come back to that in a second, which is important because, you know, to say like, well, yeah, he shouldn't end his candidacy, it's like, yeah, but then who? And we'll come back to this because I think that's something a lot of elected officials might be asking themselves too.
Yeah.
Going back to, you know, what you were saying there about, you know, this. I mean, one of the reasons that this was such a devastating, you know, debate for Biden largely was because it was confirmatory for so many people. You know, we asked in June before the debate about a number of traits among Biden and Trump. And they're, you know, and it's interesting to see both, you know, sort of the way I'm looking at this is, where is Biden among Democrats? And one of the things we want to do in this, because this is really about how Democrats feel about Biden.
Yeah, this moment, it's really,
this is what we're focused on.
That's good.
So as a way to sort of look at this, what I want to say is look at these traits and say, well, do Democrats feel that Biden has this trait? And then as a comparison point, do Republicans feel that Trump has this trait? Just to give us a sense of right. And so the areas where Biden is strongest are the areas that kind of make sense. He's strongest on honesty. 80% of Democrats think he's honest. Only 63% of Republicans think Trump is honest. Does pretty well, you know, cares about people like you. 78% of Democrats think Biden does, compared to 73% of Republicans about Trump. Again, less of a gap, still a little bit. And temperament, 81% of Democrats think that Biden has the temperament to be president. 78% of Republicans think that Trump does. So we're getting a little bit closer.
That's more on a par, yeah.
Yeah, and then we think about something where it's really on par, knowledgeable. Are they knowledgeable? 86% of Democrats say that Biden's knowledgeable. 87% of Republicans say that Trump is knowledgeable. But then we start to get to this is where the problem starts to come in. Is he competent? Now, competence means a lot, but I think it's taken on a certain, you know, it's probably taken on a certain meaning, you know, I think as we move forward in this
race. Having to do with age and health.
Yeah. Right. And we're going to ask specifically about age, but competence, you know, when I say as a proxy, 74% of Democrats, so 3 in 4, think he's competent, which is not great, given that 88% of Republicans think that Trump is competent.
Right.
To give
a point
of comparison. Strong leader. 68% of Democrats think Biden is a strong leader. 91% of Republicans think Trump is a strong leader. So over a 20-point gap there. And then in the sort of the main thing, is he too old to be president in 2025? Only 17% of Republicans think that about Trump. 45% of Democrats before the debate
thought that about Biden.
And when we looked in prior polling, you know, and we asked Democrats specifically, are they concerned about their support for Joe Biden? We saw significantly higher rates of concern among Biden supporters, right? So April polling found 42% of Biden supporters said that they had a concern about his candidacy. Again, this is well before this debate. Only 29% of Trump supporters had concerns about his candidacy. And when we look at their concerns, basically the number one concern was age, competence, you know, basically mental health, you know, mental ability, competency, health. And so this is where this confirmatory piece of this comes up. And then I'll add one more piece to this, which is why, again, this was sort of
so. Before you add that piece, I just want to note that, you know, I mean, nothing else competed in the Biden item, you know, in that open-ended question about Biden's, you know, about concerns that Biden supporters had about him. I mean, 63%, you know, said, you know, age,
mental health,
medical situation, et cetera. Everything else was in single digits.
Right.
It's the concern among Democrats.
Right. And he went out in the debate and he said, oh, it basically is, you should be concerned.
Right.
And here, and here's the thing that's, you know, and I think this is something you could kind of have a moment of departure, I think, in how you look at this other result, but I think it's kind of important. So in June, we asked a question we've asked before, you know, so among Biden supporters, you know, essentially, are you voting for Biden because you want him to be elected president mostly, primarily, or because you don't want Trump to be president? And when we're looking at this June polling, only 53% of Democrats or Joe Biden supporters said they were voting for him because they wanted him to be elected president. An almost equal share, 47%, say they were basically voting against Trump. And I say that, and you know, and again, I think you could take that in a couple different directions. You could say, you know, for those Democrats who are sort of saying, no, we got to stick with Biden, and sort of the you know, this is a certain set I have in my mind, but we'll leave it alone. I won't classify. You say, you know, I would vote for a dead Joe Biden over a Donald Trump. They exist.
Yeah.
Right. But you know, I think the other way to look at this result is to say, you know, if Biden already didn't have overwhelming support for his candidacy on its own merits, where does he stand now that his candidacy looks so damaged?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is, you know, herein lies, you know, one of the core difficulties here for Democrats is that, you know, Democrats are, you know, they're pretty closely divided. A lot of these things that we're looking at, you know, are, you know, 53, 47 or, you know, allow some don't knows or whatever. You know, you've got a little more of, you know, half of Democrats thinking a lot of things on one side or the other, whether it's both concern about his age on one hand, but also saying they're voting for him and not, you know, not going with a kind of more negative partisanship, anti-Trump thing. And that means that it fuels, it makes the argument a perpetual, you know, it adds fuel to the argument without providing a clear winning argument based on evidence for either side.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think
you know, all this really does is illustrate trouble.
I'll say, you know, and one of the things that I think is important here is, you know, I think these are, you know, pretty.
And again, we should emphasize these are all before the debate.
Right. And that's the thing. And I would say, you know, when we pull these numbers again, I expect them to get worse. Now, I should say this is in a context of, you know, a president who is reasonably popular, like with his base, right? Yeah. So if we look at June 2024, before the debate, we look at his approval ratings among Democrats, 77% approval, 13% disapproval, you know, 35% over a third have strong approval. So not, you know, not a huge problem. You know, one thing we might come back to when we talk about some of the groups in this, you know, when we look at, you know, sort of job approval and favorability by ideology, you know, one of the things like, oh, you know, well, maybe he's, you know, Biden's been weak among liberals, and there's a lot of reasons people say this, which can go back to 2020 and carry through. We could, you know, it's a whole other thing. But honestly, the most supportive of the most supportive of the president tend to be the most liberal voters, the people who are extremely liberal, approve of him more strongly. They have more favorable views of him. And so there's not like that's really where it's coming from. I mean, and to me, the whole point to make here is that, you know, it's not as though the Democratic electorate is turning on Joe Biden yet. It's just that they had serious concerns that have now been verified as worthwhile.
Well, and the other part of that, I think, is that if you look at that by party ID intensity, I think you see a similar pattern, right, in which, you know, support for Biden is strong amongst strong partisans, right? But that also sort of helps buttress the argument that if strong partisans are among his strongest defenders, they're also probably the least likely to defect if he's replaced.
Well, you know, and that's something.
Unless the replacement process is just completely.
Yeah, and I've heard some analyses, you know, in the last few weeks where and I think this is a reasonably smart hot take, which is to say, you know, the debate didn't matter. And the reason it didn't matter was because of partisanship, because of negatives of partisanship, because the vast majority of Trump supporters were going to support Trump no matter what, no matter how many, you know, lies or dissembling, whatever. And the same thing for Biden, because Trump's the other guy on stage. There's nothing that Biden can do to turn off these voters. And, you know, so therefore the debate didn't matter. And it's like, yeah, but like, and we kind of touched on this, but like, we have close elections. Like, these are close elections. And the fact is, you know, that may be the case. And there is some share of Democrats or some, you know, let's say there's a third of the electorate, I would say is a good place to start, who will vote for Joe Biden. He could die before the election. They will still vote for him on the ticket. Nothing is going to stop them from voting for the Democratic ticket, whoever it is. But there's a ceiling, and it's not far off that.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, sort of the issue here, is that it's not about the people who are diehard partisans. It's about the people who are, you know, weren't necessarily as apoplectic about the Trump presidency, but maybe didn't like it, you know? And as of right now, have forgotten most of that, because most people do, kind of move on. And now what they're hearing about is questions about whether the president is currently competent to even do his job. Well, that's not, you know, that's not really a winning coalition.
In an environment with, you know, lingering economic
uncertainty
that, you know, presidents pay for, you know, rightly or wrongly.
Exactly.
So, you know, let's talk a little bit about the, you know, the contingency if there is a succession. I mean, and, you know, there are two, you know, kind of broad schools of thought out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is, you know, there's a lot of variance in here, but, you know, one broad school of thought is that because of her position as vice president, because of the politics of the Democratic Party, that, you know, Kamala Harris has to be considered kind of the most likely and the most legitimate person to replace Biden in this scenario.
Yeah.
That's one. The other broad school of thought is no. We need to come up with some kind of process to open it up a little bit more, in which, you know, Vice President Harris would certainly be, you know, considered one of the leading contenders. But, you know, many of the other Democrats out there on the bench, and, you know, you can, you know, talk about who said they do or don't want to do
strengths
it.
Strengths,
you know,
and weaknesses, et cetera.
Right. Well, and exactly. But that there has to be some kind of process.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And there's a, you know, some ideas crazier than others. Former Clinton consultant and
what are you gonna
guy, James Carville, you know, just called the guy.
James
Carville almost killed me in a freeway in Louisiana once.
Let's save that for another podcast.
It's another podcast, but, you know, and I know it was him because I could see him behind the wheel, you know, suggested, you know, some kind of series of town halls or something.
Yeah, I've seen
you
that.
Know, or, you know, other people can, you know, debates at the convention. That was, you know, kind of a dumb John Stewart idea.
Yeah.
Sorry, John. But that was silly way to think about it. But there are those two things going on. But I mean, I think, you know, I'm pretty persuaded that I, you know, you're going to have a hard time not considering Kamala Harris the most prominent choice should Biden step down.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not saying that the arguments that we should have, that there should be a more open process are right or wrong or whatever.
Well.
But I mean, the politics of the situation are pretty hard in the Democratic Party. So what do we know about Kamala Harris in Texas?
Yeah, let's do that. We'll come back. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think one of the interesting things about Harris is that, you know, the sort of, I don't know, sort of public drumbeat, you know, often against her. And I mean, part of this to say is just, you know, vice president is a hard job, and most vice presidents kind of lose stature as the job goes on, you know, due to some oftentimes, you know, sort of the ineffectiveness of the position, right? I mean, so high profile, ineffective people usually, you know, it doesn't work out very well. But the interesting things about her is that, you know, despite, you know, what you might kind of expect, her polling numbers aren't really that bad in Texas.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, in June 2024, again, overall favorability ratings, you know, she was 35-51. Again, this is a Republican leading state, but Biden was 39-53. So she wasn't really, you know, sort of far off where he is. Thinking more about the groups we're thinking about now, right now, Democrats, right? She was 71 favorable, 14 unfavorable among Democrats. Biden was 81-12.
And we should say that, you know, within the Democratic subsample, that's outside the margin of error, but not a lot.
No, not a lot. You know, among liberals, you know, Biden was 75 favorable, 18 unfavorable. Harris was 69-15. So only really 6 points off his favorability number. And again, probably within the margin almost. Among black voters, Biden was 67-20. Among all black voters, she was 64-19. Now, in some way, that could be seen as a weakness that she's not stronger, but also she's not the candidate.
Yeah.
And so ultimately, you know, if you sort of sub her, you know, if you were to say right now, we can just, you know, Democrats say, okay, snap your fingers, sub her in. You have a candidate who has, you know, one, just say, you know, doesn't have some of the baggage that Biden has in terms of, you know, owning everything that's gone on in the first term, I would say. She has basically similar ID numbers to Biden, and she doesn't have the baggage of his age. It's not a crazy argument.
Right. I mean,
there's more to it than that, but.
Well, and I think this goes to, you know, the earlier part of the discussion, which is, or, you know, I mean, we were talking about this with a colleague before. We've talked about this a couple times.
Yeah, but, sure.
And again, this is not a novel thought, so I'm not presenting it as such.
It's been 2 weeks. We're here.
But one of the problems that, you know, the core problems here that the Biden campaign has and that Joe Biden has,
yeah,
as we said earlier, is that, you know, this is confirmatory of the most negative narrative around the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And the flip side of that is that it also completely undermines the core rationale and the core strategic impulse of the Biden campaign, which is to make the campaign about Trump, his unsuitability for office. You know, age was, you know, but also, you know, age was not a big part of that, obviously, because the Biden campaign is not going to go there. But, you know, we talked about those, that perception of competence in the trait battery we did. And as long as Joe Biden is on the ticket, that strategy, I think, is fatally compromised.
Yeah, I think it's almost impossible to execute. Right.
And so if Biden, you know, you find a way to exit Biden from the candidacy as gracefully as possible.
Mm-hmm. Very,
you know,
well,
you do to some degree over, you know, give yourself a shot of overcoming that problem.
Right.
Right. And it makes, you know, and I think when you look at the numbers you just read and, you know, I had a note card somewhere with, you know, some national, you know, that's not very different than the national numbers.
Yeah. Well,
in terms of Harris relative to Biden.
Well,
and whatever the elite complaints are about Harris, and there have been plenty, and, you know, complaints about her performance in the 2020 presidential primary, she was not a bad candidate as a vice presidential candidate.
Right.
And, you know, She is more experienced now, and I'm not making the case for her. I guess what I'm more making the case for is that I think there's an assumption out there that Kamala Harris is automatically a weak candidate.
Yeah.
And that, you know, if she does get the candidacy because of, you know, racial and ethnic politics and coalitional politics inside the Democratic Party,
which we'll get to in a second,
or the avoidance of, you know, a full-blown internal fight before the convention, you know, I think one has to be careful to deploy an unspoken assumption in that discussion.
Yeah.
That, you know, if we could, we'd just get, you know, we should just get rid of her.
Yeah.
And I think that's out there. And I understand why some people find that, you know, sexist and racist and, you know, various mixtures.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the evidence at hand, and you can talk about other, you know, how she's handled this or that,
yeah.
or, you know. But, I mean, the polling evidence at hand,
mm-hmm.
and I think the macro level evidence at hand really suggests that is a much better choice than a lot of Democrats think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I read something from Matt Iglesias, you know, sort of thinking uh-huh. about this, and I like the way that he put it. It's a bit of a sports metaphor, which I apologize for you and maybe some other people, but you know, they talk a lot in sort of advanced analytics and sports about like replacement level. And the idea, you know, that he was making was, you know, in 2020 in particular, you know, Biden was much better than your replacement level Democrat if the goal was beating Trump. Essentially, pick a random, you know, average Democrat out of the barrel, you know, Biden's way better. At this point, Biden is probably not better than a replacement level Democrat,
right.
you know, at this point because of his, and just because, again, not because of his history, I mean, just because of his liabilities at this point, right?
Yeah.
And so one, I think you say, is Harris better than a replacement level Democrat? And the answer is yes, absolutely. The polling numbers tell you that, you know, regardless of what you want to say about any sort of specifics. But the other thing, and something that I always harp on when thinking about, you know, public opinion and you know, sort of things, a lot of things in general, is like compared to what?
Yeah.
And the thing is, when Harris was being compared to all of the other options who could go up against Trump, yeah, she came up lacking. Right now, she's not being compared to all the other options going up against her. She's being compared to Biden. And so what I think you're going to see is, I think, you know, one thing I wouldn't be surprised by in the coming days is a little bit of a reassessment, especially among Democratic voters about, you know, hey, is Harris really the person I thought she was? Because she might not be that bad.
Yeah.
And I think you're going to see that. And again, whether that's real or soft, or it doesn't really matter, but her case is probably going to strengthen as time goes on. You know, to where you started on that, I think is interesting and gets to the coalitional stuff a little bit more is, you know, this idea of there's these two paths, right? There's one path, you know, that people kind of think, which is sort of a...
throw it open and have some democracy.
Yeah. I was going to set aside first the Harris one, which is, you know, there's some way that Biden steps aside and anoints her, you know, when, how. There's a bunch of legal stuff that we were kind of messing around talking about earlier. We won't get into that here, but just imagine, you know, again, all the states have their own rules. So we'll just sort of put that out there. Anyone who says, and this kind of goes to the other piece, that there's some simple way, you know, or some, you know, way that... that the process will be opened up. And I think there's a reason Democrats are talking about that, right? I mean, in the sense of if democracy and representation is going to be one of your big themes, it's a little weird to have like a backroom decision about who the nominee for the party is going to be.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it kind of, so that's a little bit problematic. You can understand why the impulse is there. Having said all that, you know, for those of us who, you know, for those of you who listen to this podcast in Texas politics and follow Texas politics closely and thinking about, you know, speakers' races and other things, you know, there are a lot of people who would take that job. And there are a lot of people with a lot of clout who have different, you know, and the amount of multidimensional chess and resource throwing and backstabbing and politicking that needs to go on inside whatever process they establish is like just so mind-blowingly monumental that anyone who thinks like, well, no, they just, Biden just steps down and then the convention will just throw it open. It's like, yeah. Uh-huh. And that's like before you even talk about the state level rules that we're just mentioning that like, you know, maybe the ballot's set. You know, I mean, there's all kinds there's all kinds of other stuff out there. So in and of itself, people talking about that are a little bit, it's a little bit too just kind of like, well, we just do the normative. We just do this and then it'll be fine. And I don't think there is a this out there right now that's like clear, legal, obvious, whatever. At the same time, you know, just some kind of talking about some different sort of final big picture thoughts here. You know, this is part of what I think is, you know, what you're seeing is at least up to this point, the reluctance among a lot of elected Democrats to step forward relative to the volume of chatter on the left about Biden, you know, having to leave the ticket. And I think part of it is, you know, if you're an elected official, one, you're risk averse by nature. And a big question I think any elected official needs to ask themselves or would be asking themselves, well, who are you replacing him with?
Yeah.
And, you know, it depends on your position in the party, your position in your reelection campaign. And also, again, who the candidate's going to be. I mean, you know, it's a different answer if you're a moderate, you know, sort of who's in a swing district versus, you know, your AOC, your Greg Kassar, you know, whatever.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and you're obviously seeing that play out as, you know, some of the, you know, people like John Tester in Montana, you know, some of these senators that are in very close races in swing states or in red, you know, outright red states and Senator Tester's
And a lot of the people who
are coming out and saying, yeah, this is, you know, he should go.
Yeah. And I think, and if you're a lot of the people who aren't in one of those situations, I mean, one of the you know, sort of team player things you do is to not come out and say what you think, because it really is, you know, I mean, not to say it's like, there is, what does John Tester want here, is actually a relevant question in this, yeah. you know, if you're a Democrat who's likely to get reelected. You know, the other sort of interesting, you know, a couple other interesting things about this, you know, the role of the Black Caucus in all of this.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, they've come out firmly
in the House. Yeah.
In the House. They've come out firmly behind Biden as of right now. You know, just looking up the numbers in Texas among Black Democrats, Biden's approval was 74-13, 83 favorable, 7 unfave. Pretty similar to Harris, I'll say. She was 81-10. I think just that's about name ID difference, not much. You know, 60, you know, I said before, 53% of Democrats want Joe Biden to be elected president. 65% of Black Democrats want Joe Biden to be elected president, as opposed to 35% who want to keep Donald Trump from being elected. So they're in a, you know, the Black Caucus is an interesting position here. I mean, both in terms of, you know, Joe Biden's sort of reliance on and credit given to the Black Caucus and Black voters for his nomination in 2020. They're so core, you know, sort of to his identity here. You know, at the same time, I mean, I think, you know, if, I mean, I think you were pointing this out earlier, I mean, I want to state your argument, but I mean, basically, if they can keep Biden in for a long time, ultimately Harris becomes eventually the de facto alternative, which I think would be fine with the Black Caucus too. And to add on the piece I was sort of saying before, also a lot of the members of the Black Caucus come from districts that are safely Democratic. And so, you know, they're not really thinking about the coattail issue about, you know, a ballot.
At least not in their own self-interest.
Yeah, not in their own self-interest.
Or at least not directly. I mean, I think that's it's another thing that's brewing here.
Yeah, I mean,
look, you could, you know, it's not inconsistent with that argument to say that, you know, if you're a senior member in the Congressional Black Caucus,
right,
you know, you are very interested in what is a very reasonable a very reasonable shot at Democrats taking the House back.
Yeah, and I should add,
you know, that's good for your self-interest.
And I should add, and you know, you didn't mention this in the Harris discussion, but just to put it in here too, you know, the idea of the Democratic Party leaving Joe Biden, you know, whether he initiates it or not, how it gets initiated, what happens, and passing over.
Yeah, well,
Harris
that's what I
is
meant.
Just, you know,
it's hard to, you know, it's just,
it'd be politically suicidal.
Politically very difficult, and I think that's why people that don't want to see Harris, you know, look, just because you may like Kamala Harris and still think that the internal selection process for a potential replacement should be more deliberative and participatory than just
this person.
Assuming that the vice president is the next person in line.
Yeah, sure.
You know, that said,
yeah.
You know, there are also strategic reasons. I mean, I think, you know, some of the people that are calling for this more deliberative process are trying to find a workaround.
Yeah.
Without coming out and saying, you know, I don't think she's up for the job.
Right. I think that's right.
You know, so.
You know, we mentioned, you know, sort of the liberals in the party already a little bit, you know, in the sense that, you know, Biden's numbers are relatively good amongst sort of the most liberal voters. You know, but it is notable. I mean, other than sort of Lloyd Doggett, the left wing of the party has been pretty quiet. If anything, they've backed Biden. You know, it's been the opposite.
Yeah. AOC.
Yeah.
You know, it was an early, you know, somebody who you know, was an early buck up. Stick with our guy.
And I might be cynical here, but I think to some extent, you know, if you're a liberal in the Democratic Party after a number of years, you know, you're not looking to have this blood on your hands, and you don't need to because it's not for you. Again, AOC is in a safe district. You know, most of the people in the squad are coming from pretty safe, pretty liberal districts where, you know.
Right. The ones that are in trouble are already in trouble, and we're not hearing from them anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, George Clooney. Throw him out there.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned Clooney in the beginning. I think you're right. And, you know, to the extent that this is sort of insight into a donor decision, but there was interesting, you know, gossipy coverage this morning, I think it was either Politico or Punchbowl that, you know, Clooney apparently did have a conversation with former President Obama and let him know he was going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like, you know, President Obama can control what George Clooney does. But the spin on that was that Obama was kind of, you know, got to do what you got to do. So, you know, it's kind of the implication of that.
Well, I think ultimately, I mean, you know, it's a weird, you know, and this is sort of, it's something that I think you know, it's a mixture of something that sounds, you know, cliche and cynical. So I'm really excited to say it.
Oh, good.
But, you know, although the George Clooney op-ed is stupid, it does speak to, you know, the importance of the donor universe in this. Like, I understand that Biden and his internal team, it's easy to dismiss a bunch of second term congressmen as not knowing right. What's up.
Or, it's, you know, Obama former advisors. I mean, you know.
Yeah, people who, you know, you were never tight with to begin with.
Who've been critical, you know, I mean, David Axelrod has been critical of the Biden administration. You know, I mean, not horribly so, but, you know, enough that it bothered the Biden people and Biden himself reportedly.
Yeah. And again, not knowing Biden personally, you know, I do nonetheless wonder, you know, if he's not going to be getting, I mean, like, one of the things I think that they're tracking in addition to the polling numbers right now is the impact this has had on his campaign finance.
Yeah.
You know, to the extent that small dollar donors are declined because of this, to the extent that the people who write million and $10 million checks to the party, to the super PACs, decide, you know, like, I'm not going to make this investment. And ultimately, it is an investment. It's an investment.
Yeah, you know, or based I'm going to ship my investment elsewhere to a place I think is more important. There were some early reports of donors, big donors, saying that they were going to shift their emphasis to contributions to congressional races, the House and Senate races.
And that's right. And I think, you know, that's something where, you know, if you're Biden, you're thinking, okay, like, am I going to be able, not only, you know, physically, mentally set that aside, but like, do I have the resources to compete, or am I not going to be able to do that? I think that's something that's actually going to push them more than another House Democrat saying they're not, you know, they're not sure about right. Biden. I mean, and then there's a flip side to this too that also relates. I mean, I think, you know, as much as, yes, some of those donors will shift their money, one of the things that, you know, Biden can't do right now, and I don't know if he's going to be able to, is he can't go and do big money fundraisers for down ballot candidates right now. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of Democrats right now who are saying,
they're
dying
for him to come.
Yeah, come to their district. And I mean, that's just, you know, and you think about a ticket.
Yeah.
That's not great. So, I mean, maybe, you know, that's a good place to kind of come to one last thing, which is the Senate race here in Texas, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I think eventually this play, you know, this has some kind of impact on this race, but mm-hmm. this race is also so still kind of underdeveloped at this point. You know, I'm reticent to say too much about it, honestly. I mean, I don't, you know, I've been reticent about this race all along.
Yeah.
The polling numbers have been a little bit weird. The polling itself has been a little bit weird. We've got a lot of likely voter polls out there that, quote unquote, that show this race closer than we've been seeing it in the general RV polls.
Yeah.
And, you know, but, you know, the one consistent characteristic is that if you take out forces and things like this, there's still, like, not a lot of attention being paid this race by partisans on either side.
You know, that's important, though, I think, to the analysis here, right? Which is, if you take out the forces, you know, it kind of looks a little bit wider. If you start to look at these LV polls are coming out, you know, you'd think the race is kind of tightening up. But this is actually the issue here. You know, there's already been a pretty notable enthusiasm gap in the polling that we've done, right? So over half of Republicans in last polls said they were extremely enthusiastic about voting the 2024 election, 55%, compared to only 39% of Democrats. And so, you know, I mean, this is a whole other discussion in some ways. There's a lot we could talk about here, because that gap has been growing throughout the year between Republicans and Democrats. And the thing is, what's happened in the last couple of weeks is not likely to increase Democratic enthusiasm. Now, some arguments would be that I think I've seen floating around, which I think are smart arguments, but I think a little bit decontextualizes this idea that, you know, in Texas right now, is the top of the, you know, sort of a question or a statement, is the top of the ticket really driving results? Because we've seen House candidates in the legislature, you know, overperform the presidential ticket. We've seen John Cornyn in key areas overperform the presidential ticket. So this question of who's leading who. A lot of people look to Beto O'Rourke's campaign and sort of say, you know, if you look at that, you'd actually say that really, you know, what's going on at the sub-level against Cruz is really what's going to do this. It's not going to be about the presidential race. And I'm just going to kind of throw my hands like, I don't think so. Like, you know, I mean, real quick, just to remind people, and I'm just going to just real quick, right? O'Rourke did really well because he was a high-quality candidate. I think Allred's a high-quality candidate. O'Rourke had the fortune of running in Trump's first midterm election. Right?
Very, very good context for his election.
Very good context for Democrats everywhere. And I'll add to that one other thing, which was that same momentum that pushed O'Rourke into the race, that pushed, you know, him sort of as an anti-Trump sentiment among Democrats. It also pushed tons and tons of down ballot Democrats to run in races they hadn't been running in all throughout the state. So the number of, you know, House candidates went up, the number of, you know, basically local candidates went up among Democrats. And, you know, the benefit of that is you're running campaigns everywhere. I mean, O'Rourke can be in one place. Democrats were really running that election cycle, and it, you know, against Cruz, that came close. The idea, therefore, though, that race is going to kind of like drive things, and therefore the presidential is not going to be as, like, I'm just a little, I'm a little skeptical because once you put Trump on the ticket, put Biden on the ticket, that is going to be driving the discussion. You know, I mean, we'll see. But I'm just the idea that, you know, there's going to be a huge divergence between the presidential ballot and the Senate ballot in Texas. I don't see a huge divergence happening, but we'll see.
Yeah. I mean, it's not clear like what the in advance of seeing what happens, that what the why is for that scenario.
Yeah. Right? Well, and then you'd also have to play this
and,
out.
You know, people will make the argument and somebody will, you know, if anybody hears this, that, you know, they will write us and say, look, here's the argument. And that's great. But
it's just hard to play out an argument where, you know, let's say Biden is a nominee, he underperforms, you know, past Democratic nominees, or, you know, we see a deviation from the trend line of tightening election cycles. But nonetheless, Allred somehow, you know, tightens that up with Cruz. Yeah, I mean,
I might accept the argument that depending on what the Biden replacement looks like, you know, the Democrats could ultimately get a little bit of a boost out of this, and that could help the Senate race, right?
Yeah.
But to your point, I still think that is a top of the ballot down phenomenon, not a bottom of the ballot up phenomenon.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? I think that's right. You know, I mean, I think to step back to close it out, I mean, what I, you know, the problems that the Democrats have right now are so big. I mean, you know, as we sit here and we talk about, well, you know, there's this line of discussion about this, you know, about the succession, the line of discussion about what the right thing, you know, who owes by, what is loyalty,
right?
Versus, you know, you're just, you know, we're forming a circular firing squad.
Or what's even in everybody's self-interest. And when you say everybody, it's like the electorate, the elected officials, the part, I mean,
yeah, all of those discussions, you know, are counter to the campaign that the Democrats, and in particular Joe Biden and the Biden campaign, have laid out for themselves.
Right.
And I think there is no going back to the strategy that they wanted to pursue in this race. And that means that the way forward, you know, is going to be fraught, even if Joe Biden digs in and won't listen to anybody. And
even if he performs better.
And, yeah, you know, and it does not get out of the race. That strat, you know, they need a new strategy now because I don't think there's going to be a way to go back to the old one. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to, you know, one of the guiding lights of this podcast, which is we've been swimming around for the last 45 minutes in a very choppy ocean of uncertainty.
Yeah.
Right. What we're doing is chasing down all these, you know, rabbit trails. And, you know, old ones are, you know, some of those trails are caving in and some of them are opening up, you know, even more frequently than day to day.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, at this point, the uncertainty around this, you know, is kind of the Democrats' biggest problem. All of those, and that's kind of what I was trying to get at when I was talking about all of those, you know, 52%.
Yeah, terrible.
You know, among Democrats, pick your measure.
Yeah, exactly.
You know. Or even the ones that are, you know, 70, you know, there's not going to be an easy consensus here.
Yeah.
And it's also going to take trying to get some elites and some voters, and especially Joe Biden, you know, this maybe shows my hand a little bit, you know, to look at some very hard realities in that. Because the path forward for Joe Biden seems to me to have, you know, the path to victory, if one exists, is, you know, just very, very, very narrow.
Yeah.
And I just don't think they have an argument for that at this point.
Yeah, I mean, anecdotally.
At least not a persuasive one.
No, I mean, anecdotally, I think, you know, what confirms that so clear is what we haven't talked about since the debate. And by we, I just hasn't been a story, which is Trump's conviction, right? That was exactly what, you know, Democratic campaigns were waiting for. They were waiting for the convictions to come down. They were ready to, you know, sort of run on that message. And that has been totally pushed aside to talk about Biden. And that's like the exact example.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one aspect of that, you know, the fact that, you know, we were going to make this a focus on Donald Trump. That was going to be one of many negative things that made, you know, out of tribute to President Biden, who's, you know, taken on a lot of water in the last couple of weeks. You know, his oft-repeated, you know, don't compare me to the Almighty, compare me to the alternative. Well, the problem is he's not squaring up to the alternative quite the way that they had hoped to frame this election. And I they're going to have a very hard time going back on that. So with that, thanks for being here, Josh. As always, thanks again to our excellent production team in the Dev Studio and the College of Liberal Arts here at UT Austin. All the data that we talked about today you will find at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be off again for a couple weeks. It is summer, but there'll be doubtless a lot to talk about when we get back. But after that, we'll be back in a couple weeks with another Second Reading Podcast. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.